Welcome to the AOA podcast series on Lessons in Leadership. My name is Ann Van Heest, and I'm honored to serve as the 2023-2024 AOA president. As discussed in our August 25th podcast, part of my AOA presidential duties includes joining the Orthopedic Carousel of Presidents from five different English-speaking countries, and I have the unique opportunity to attend each of their annual meetings. Our AOA is a leadership organization. As we discuss in Lessons in Leadership, we can learn so much from the leaders of other countries. The diversity of our profession includes the diversity of orthopedic surgery in other countries all over the world, and this allows us to compare and contrast to our own. One of the annual meetings that I'm excited to attend is the British Orthopedic Association meeting, or BOA, in Liverpool, England, from September 19th to September 22nd, 2023. I am pleased and honored to host the BOA 2023 president, Dr. Deborah Eastwood, to our podcast today to discuss lessons in leadership from her vantage point. Thank you, Deborah, for joining me today for this conversation.
My pleasure.
So just to start first for our listening audience, can you tell us a little bit about the BOA and its upcoming meeting?
Sure. So the British Orthopaedic Association is actually 105 years old this year, and it actually started at the instigation of some of your colleagues from a while ago. So the American orthopods were working with us in the field hospitals during World War I. You'd already got an orthopaedic association, and it was felt by the American surgeons that we were lacking in that respect. So it was working together that helped us form our British Orthopaedic Association.
So the AOA started in 1887, and when did the BOA start?
The BOA started in 1918.
So we have a long association with our organizations.
We do. And it's been, I think, certainly to the benefit of the British Orthopaedic Association over the years to have such close ties.
So tell me about your upcoming meeting.
So our meeting is a membership benefit, which is one of the interesting things about the BOA. So, of course, we ask for subscription fees from our members, but then you can attend the meeting as a member benefit. So we hope by doing that, that we get a lot of involvement of our members in the meeting. Our theme this year is sustainable systems. And by that, I mean sustainability and the big issues at the moment, which are recruitment of the best, retention of the best workers in our profession. We've got to be sustainable in how we teach and train in these days. We've obviously got to be sustainable in a financial setting. And you can't ignore the green agenda at the moment. And we have to have sustainability in that field too.
So tell me a little bit, how many orthopedic surgeons are there that are part of British Orthopedic Association? And what percentages of that of all orthopods?
So I think our membership is running at around 80 to 85% of all available consultant orthopaedic surgeons. It goes up and down a little bit. Our membership, of course, like many others, includes our trainees and it includes allied health professions. So mainly our physiotherapists can be members of the association and our arthroplasty care practitioners, so their extended scope nurse practitioners. So they can be members as well as medical students and the like. So our overall membership is probably around 4,000, 4,500, and I'm hoping that 2,000 to 2,500 will be at our Congress.
That sounds amazing. As a leadership podcast, I'm interested in your journey to becoming president of the BOA. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey and any tips that you may have for our young leaders?
So I know this, I know I'm supposed to have had a plan, but I never did. And you know me well enough now to know that to be true. So I'd have
Well, that's one strategy, is to have no plan and see what happens. Yes. Serendipity.
Yes, and that's exactly the word I was going to use. And I think I have never been what I consider a natural leader, but I have tried to do things to make our lives better, our patients' lives better, our colleagues' lives better, my friends' lives better. And I think I probably had an early, what I'd call flirtation with leadership, when at a junior stage I was on the board of the British Society of Children's Orthopaedic Surgeons. And I think at that time I did not quite realise that there are always games to be played and that there are rules to the game, which are informal and flexible. And I'm not saying I played the game wrongly, but I didn't get... I had never been a leader in the British Society of Children's Orthopaedic Surgery. I've loved Europe, and a little bit by being in the right place at the right time, I did get to be president of the European Paediatric Orthopaedic Society, and that was a very exciting period of change. And when you've sort of tasted the ability to change things and working closely with colleagues with a shared purpose to bring about change. So that was very inspiring for us.
So it sounds to me like your early starts were by getting affiliated with your subspecialty society.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's an important lesson, I think. And you were at a resident level at that time?
No, I was a junior attending.
Yeah. So again, I think getting your foot in the door, putting your toe in the water, testing the temperature and seeing what you think of it. And now, you liked it.
Yeah. And now that there are so many, not so many, but there are good trainee associations. So we have the British Orthopaedic Trainees Association, and they work very well together. So if you're a keen resident, you could be involved and engaged with that association. And I think my advice to them, for example, is sort of if you're unhappy with your lot or what you perceive the problems to be, then perhaps don't just moan on the sidelines, but actually ask your committees or ask your associations or tell them this is a problem and tell them what's the solution or can you help to find a solution. So as you say, you've got to be engaged and willing to put yourself out there a little bit to make change happen.
So I love that tidbit. So just to reiterate, the tidbit is, if you're unhappy with your situation, don't just moan on the sidelines, but become engaged and try to facilitate change.
Yeah.
And that's a great path to leadership.
I think it is, you know, and we all moan on the sidelines. So that's never going to change. But I'd like to think that both you and I, you know, we may have moaned, but then we've thought, you know what, maybe we could do something. Maybe we could achieve something.
So you were highly motivated because you wanted to make change and you wanted to help your profession.
Yes. And I think at one stage you realize that whilst it's essentially one patient at a time, focus on one patient in front of you, and that's how you get through a long clinic or how you get through a long operating list. You do your best for the patient in front of you. But then I think at some stage you realize that in order to care for that patient well, you may have to change the system behind that patient, and the system that allows you to treat that patient, maybe that does need changing.
So tell us a little bit about the BOA itself. When did you get involved with the BOA, and how did those leadership opportunities come about?
Early stage of my consultant career, I applied for and got onto our council, which is about 20 people. And I was on that for the requisite 3 years. And then I came off, and I remember as I came off thinking, I had not achieved anything during that three. I'd learned a lot and I'd enjoyed my time, but either I hadn't been proactive enough or the system hadn't encouraged me, or both. So I came off and then I went and did my European leadership of the Paediatric Orthopaedic Society, and then that finished. And I thought, okay, I still want to do more, so I'm going to come back now from Europe Paediatric to British General. And so I applied to be on council, in fact, went for one of their leadership positions, was encouraged to do that. So I was secretary of the association before I went on the presidential line.
So then my follow-up question would be, it sounds like getting involved at the council level, the first time you're mostly learning about the organization, and then later you came back to contribute.
Yes. And I think in the years since I was first on council, we've now got, some might say, too many committees. I'd like to think we've got it just right. And so now I would encourage people to come on to something like the Educational Careers Committee or the Research Committee. You don't have to do that, but that's quite a nice option for just testing your interest in the committee structure. I think we've also strengthened our engagement in council, and we're encouraging younger people to apply and be involved. COVID has helped us embrace hybrid meetings, hasn't it? And whilst we don't want to do evening meetings all the time, some meetings done hybrid in an evening mean that you encourage a different group, perhaps, or make it somewhat easier for people to attend.
Yes, certainly that's one of the small silver linings, is that our meetings can be remote, although many of us can spend a full evening on Zoom.
And I think that has to be remembered, because it's not as if instead of having the meeting from 12 till 2, we have it from 6 till 8, but we still work 12 till 2. So yes, we are extending our working day. And I think we have to be very careful of that, because that's not sustainable either.
So you started as secretary and then worked your way up the...
Yeah.
And any helpful hints for young individuals who are looking to advance to those kind of levels?
So I put my hat in the ring for president because it came clear to me that we needed a different viewpoint. And that could have been done by any of my male colleagues. But I also thought that maybe being female, for once in my life, I actually had that at the forefront of my mind. And I thought being female, being a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, having done European leadership, that I did have some different experiences to offer the BOA.
So tell us about putting your hat in the ring. I know oftentimes that's something that we think we need to be 100% qualified in order to try something. Have you ever put your hat in the ring and not gotten accepted at something?
Yes, of course, because otherwise I probably haven't applied for enough posts. But I have been lucky over my career time. I have been lucky in that the posts, certainly latterly, that I have chosen to apply for, I have been lucky. I mean, you make your own luck, but I've been the right person at the right time to do that post.
Well, we're very honored to have you as the BOA president, and I'm glad you put your hat in the ring and got lucky at being chosen. Sometimes it isn't just luck. Sometimes it's also the career that you've built and the experience that you've had, as you mentioned, with your pediatric subspecialty society as well as within the organization itself.
I think if you don't put your hat in the ring, you never know. And I think any voting membership sort of deserves a range of candidates. And I know not everyone agrees with that, but I think you deserve not a dozen candidates, but at least one or two candidates for each position. Because the right person at the right time, that's a little bit up to your voting members or your council or whoever is choosing you.
Okay, let's move on next to critical issues. So the AOA is an organization that is committed to identifying and discussing critical issues in orthopedic surgery. What do you see as the critical issues that are facing the BOA at this time?
So the critical issues are many. I think you'd have to say backlog of cases is one huge issue. At least we know the scale of the problem. And I think that the benefits of a national health service are to a certain extent that we can come up with a national plan. That sounds very grand, and we haven't really got that, but that's what we're aiming to. Our second critical issue is undoubtedly that there is a deep unhappiness with the system at present. And as we were discussing before we started this recording, Anne, we are facing a significant disruption from industrial action, unprecedented.
So tell me what industrial action means.
So it means that our tier of junior doctors, not that we like that word, but there is a non-attendings, I would say. So they are on strike, and then the consultants are on strike too. So
just so that we're clear for our audience, who is a junior doctor in your system?
So everything from an intern up to an attending. So they are 10 years post-qualification. They are not necessarily junior in that respect. So when they are on strike and when we are on strike, we run what we call a Christmas Day service, because Christmas Day in the UK is still a very specific holiday day where you really don't do anything that you don't have to do. So of course you do emergency work, urgent work, if it could wait, maybe, safely for the patients. But that's what we're doing at the moment. We're providing a Christmas Day service on those strike days.
And what role do you think the BOA plays in this industrial action by your orthopedic surgeons? And I assume all of your colleagues, both junior doctors and consultants.
Yes. So our strapline, of which I am proud, is for caring for patients, supporting surgeons so that we can transform their lives through MSK Health. So to care for patients is difficult if none of us are working. That is tricky. But we have to support our surgeons. And so we are not a trade union, but we do want to support our surgeons. So we therefore support them in their right to act how they feel they need to act in order to bring about change. So many of our colleagues are taking industrial action. many are choosing not to. The ones who are not undertaking industrial action still have many of those concerns and feel that the system is broken. So they still have those concerns. It's just that they choose not to make their voice heard by not working.
And what are the major issues that the consultants feel is broken in the system?
So I think they would say the headline is that it's pay. But I think it's as much conditions and terms of service, and that we feel that we've lost autonomy in patient care and that the managers are dictating how and what we do. Now, it's a two-way thing. If we allow them to dictate how and what we do, then we need to step up to the plate and perhaps take more of an active role. The other argument would be that we've been doing that for years and we're just worn down and we're not making any progress.
So it seems like that is an international theme that we could learn from, and it seems like the AOA would be very interested in that we are a leadership organization, and one of the issues that is confronting orthopedists across the world is our lack of leadership. That loss of autonomy in running your orthopedic surgery care of musculoskeletal patients is starting to be dictated to us instead of us being able to dictate. And that's a similar situation.
Very much so. And I think we've all sort of got used to a fact that a theatre list will start late, run slowly, but still maybe finish late, or finish early, but not early enough to allow you to do an extra case. And I think we've just got to get up and get at it again somehow. I know that we are all hard workers and we've not got much energy left, but if you start the day with a positive attitude and try and crack on with the day, then I think everyone feels happier if they've worked a bit harder during the day and you do what you have to do. But it's difficult to impart that feeling to others who are a bit worn down.
What other critical issues do you think are in front of the BOA?
Talked about the backlog, talked about unhappiness in our staff, and I think equality, diversity, inclusion, equity, diversity, inclusion is an ongoing issue. I think I'm really proud of the BOA. I think we have made huge advances in the last few years. And I'm not saying we are done, because of course we're nowhere near done. But I do think that in many ways we are now pushing through an open door, for example, in terms of gender. I'd also say in terms of ethnicity. And now we just need to look back and make sure that everyone else is coming through that door with us so that we have a much more equitable society.
Do you have any information about your gender or ethnicity diversity figures for BOA?
So the headline figure is a figure I swore I wouldn't ever say this year. Only 7.8 of our consultant staff are female. And that is the lowest of all the surgical specialties. And in that, I think we mirror America.
Yes, that's similar.
But I don't like quoting that figure because I don't think it's representative of what we're doing at the moment. So 30% of our residents for the last 3 years now have been women. We have nothing to suggest that they fail to make it through training less well than the men. We're looking into that a little bit further, but there's no real obvious, and there's nothing to say they don't get a consultant post at the end of it. And in fact, 20% of the consultant appointments last year went to women. So 30% of the trainees are women at the moment, and 20% of the appointments went to women last year. I think that's proof.
The future is bright.
Yeah, they're getting through the system, and the future is very bright, yes.
And how about racial and ethnicity figures?
So I think that's quite varied over the UK. But for example, in the Greater London area, I would say it's at least 50-50 mix of people who would say that they are Asian or British Asian versus white British. So I think the ethnicity data is getting better too. Traditionally, a lot of our ethnic minorities have been doing non-attending posts. So they have been slightly sidelined many years ago into a post which is clinically very similar to ours, but just not quite at the same level, a two-tier system. We are bringing those people back into the fold, and I think the figures now for ethnicity are much better and are not just explained by that group of surgeons. So we've got real changes in the ethnicity mix.
And regarding pipeline and trying to get a gender and racial ethnicity mix at the leadership level, as you mentioned, you are a female president of the BOA. Has that ever happened before?
Yeah, so it's been great. A bit like you. I'm not the first, you know, and it's so nice. Because, oh, you must be the first. No, been there, done that. We've had the first. So,
well, you and I have that in common.
Yeah, so, and that does make a difference. And if you look at our trainees association at the moment, their ethnicity and their gender mix at council level and at the presidential level is very different from what you would expect to be. Since I became secretary of the British Orthopaedic Association, when I was the only diversity on council in terms of gender, we now have 30% of our council are women. If you look at the British Orthopaedic Trainees Association, their positions of responsibility are British Asian to a large extent and female to a large extent. So between the two, we've probably got some work to do. But again, I have great faith that the pipeline is working and that with encouragement and opportunity, we will get there. And the BOA has also made a concerted effort, certainly this last year or two, to encourage a different sort of person to apply for our council positions. And I think
again, it sounds like a recurrent theme to put your hat in the ring, even if you are a little bit different than the standard leadership that an organization has seen.
The other thing that I'm proud about, we've done quite a lot on parental leave benefits and flexibility in training. We haven't got there yet, but trying to keep couples together sounds straightforward, doesn't it? But in our system, it can have two medical careers having to commute an hour and a half in opposite directions and still be expected to come home at night. So we can't keep every trainee happy with the perfect lifestyle in the perfect setting. But I think we need to work harder at that.
Well, that segues nicely into our next topic. So it's great that you're trying to provide flexibility in training, flexibility for two career families, and flexibility for parental leave. But our AOA membership includes many leaders that are committed to educating competent orthopedic surgeons. And presently, we're rolling out competency-based education across the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about orthopedic surgery training in Britain and what your experience is with competency-based medical education?
So our training is long, perhaps too long, and it starts quite general. And maybe it doesn't need to do that in every case. And then we've got the 6 years of an orthopedic residency program.
So just for our membership, could you outline from when do you go to medical school and then what is the path from medical school to being a consultant? Yeah.
So medical school aged 18, qualify at 22, 23, 2 years as an intern rather than one. And then you can go, by then you should know whether you want to be surgical or medical. So then I might say I definitely surgical, but not sure quite what. So I go into core surgical training where I try out a few specialties and then I can apply to be an orthopedic registrar for years 3 to 8. So 2 years general, 6 years in orthopedics.
And would that include a fellowship
yes.
or when does the subspecialty training
yes,
occur?
That would come at the part of that 8 years. Yeah. Now, if I knew that I was a diehard orthopod right from the start, then I can miss out the core surgical training and go straight into specialty training, but a little bit lower level. I have been competency-based for a while in name, but perhaps not in practice so much. But it changed a couple of years ago. So we now have a set criteria that we judge our trainees on. So we have capabilities in practice. And those are the sorts of things like, can you manage an outpatient clinic? Can you manage the unselected emergency admissions? Can you manage a ward round and the ongoing care? And can you manage an operating list? So none of that says you have to do that on your own, but you're supposed to be helping to run your practice. And then we've got many different generic professional capabilities that we talk about, like preventing health and illness prevention, your professional skills and knowledge, your research basis. So we test on all of those. And we now, instead of you being my trainee and I just assessing you, and if we didn't like each other or didn't get on, I wouldn't give you very high grades. I think none of those statements go together, but that's the fear. So we now have a multi-consult or multi-attending report. So everyone within the department, and our departments are smaller than yours, we'd get together 3 months into their 6 months attachment, and we'd talk about each of the trainees and decide where their strengths and weaknesses were and what we could do differently in the next 3 months of their attachment to try and improve their competences. You know.
And is there a formal process that that's called? What is that called?
I think that's just a review. We have a formal review. So the residency program director will see them all once a year. They should be assessed every 3 months by their local supervisors.
That sounds very similar to our clinical competency committees that are required twice a year for every resident in every program in the United States.
Yeah. So I think we've tried to bring the assessments right back down to local level. And I think that it is more time consuming for the attending, for the consultant. And of course, we've had difficulties with some not doing their part in their as a trainer. And I think we're probably going to get to the stage where just because you're an attending does not mean you have the right to have a trainee, which would be a little bit of a shake-up for the British system. We've always assumed you have a trainee whether you treat them well or not.
It sounds like another issue that is present in your system that I think other systems struggle with as well is the subjectivity of assessment.
Yes.
And that sometimes the subjectivity of assessment may have some implicit bias or some discrimination or either positive or negative, that you want a certain person to do well or not do well. And what kind of mechanisms have you used to try to minimize that bias?
So I think the most important thing has been training conscious bias to try and make sure that we are giving everyone a fair assessment. I think by having several of us talking together, it can be quite clear if two of you think this trainee is fantastic and one thinks they aren't fantastic. So that means we have to work out why it is. What side of the trainee have you seen that the others haven't seen? And it could be that both assessments are correct, because the truth often lies in the middle somewhere. But I think the more opinions you take within reason, it helps get a fairer opinion. And the trainees have the ability to comment on us as well. That goes higher up the ladder, and I won't see that for another year and a half or so. So I should not be able to pinpoint which trainee thought I was a bad trainer.
Interesting. So assessment of both the trainees and the trainers are an important aspect of CompC-based medical education that you've been working hard on.
Yeah.
So what about surgical skills assessments? Do you think you're training competent orthopedic surgeons, and how do you verify that they are able to operate?
So I, of course, like to think we're training competent orthopedic surgeons. Otherwise, of course, I think we are, and I know we are. So we would assess that in theatre. We call them work-based assessments or case-based discussions, but the surgical skills is usually a workplace assessment. In an ideal world, and this doesn't always happen, but in an ideal world, I would discuss, say, on a Monday, what we're doing on the operating list on, say, Wednesday, say what we're doing, what technique I plan, encourage the trainee to read up on it, look at some videos online, come prepared, know the anatomy, talk me through it, and then depending on what stage they're at, I will allow them to do the whole operation on their own with me, scrubbed and supervising, or I will start them off, or they will start off, and we sort of keep going as their skill set dictates. And then at the end of the procedure, not every procedure, but they can fill in an assessment. I like them to fill in what they think they did well and what they think they did badly. Then they can send it to me. I will adjust it. And then I can sign it off without discussing it with them. In an ideal world, we'll sit down over coffee the next day and say, I saw your form. I've completed my bit. And then we chat about it. quite a few of the educationalists would say that's wrong to have it done remotely and that we should always make time to sit down, because it isn't every case that we do it on.
And are your trainees required to do specific numbers of cases or achieve a certain competency level on certain case types?
So they're supposed to achieve a competency level 4, which implies that they're competent to do the operation on their own, that they can anticipate problems and deal with them as they come along. They also have to have completed time. And so the residency program director says, yes, you are competent and capable of sitting the exam. And then if you sit the exam and pass the exam, that's the final tick box. But you cannot go forward to the exam unless your residency program director thinks that you are competent and capable and ready.
And do you have any case number minimums?
We expect 1,800 cases. And that is not a hard and fast rule. And they have to be over a range of procedures. We tried to make it more generic so that it was more, you have to have done 10 osteotomies and know the principles of an osteotomy, the principles of deformity analysis, principles of various fixation methods, but you didn't have to have done 20 hallux valgus osteotomies, you know. But that didn't quite get through, so we still have quite specific numbers. You have to have done 5 supracondylar humeral fractures, for example. You have to have done, I don't know how many hallux valgus operations, but there is a specific number. Our trainees pre-COVID were averaging over 3,000 operations. So they do get the numbers. And even during COVID years where their numbers went right down, there are few people who have, at the end of their training, not got the minimum. Have to have done your 5 supracondylar, you have to have done 10 knee replacements or whatever the figure is. So there are some trainees dashing around in their final 6 months saying, I need to do one more knee replacement. I'm going to be a spine surgeon, but I need to do one more knee replacement.
And again, for us, that's what we would call the depth and breadth of orthopedic surgery, where you need to demonstrate a certain level of competence or a certain depth of experience. And then a certain breadth of experience, so everybody gets the ability to see everything. So you mentioned that pre-COVID, there had been 3,000 cases on average per trainee during their six years of orthopedic surgery. What challenges have COVID brought about, and do you think that Britain has rebounded?
So many units would say they have not rebounded to pre-COVID levels yet. So when I asked all our different clinical directors around the country, say in May, quite a few said they were not back to pre-COVID levels of activity. The national figures suggest that our admissions for elective operation around the country are back to pre-COVID levels just. So now it's a matter of, are we willing to train on those lists, given that training on a list may take a bit longer, and maybe it means that you can't get through the backlog quite as quickly. I think most trainers want to train. If you are moving cases as we are doing, we're buying National Health Service time from the private sector. So we're taking some of our national health cases into the private sector to operate on them there. That is supposed to come with a training requirement that the private hospitals would quite like us to be quicker and get out of there quickly. So that's where, again, even in the NHS, money is coming into that sort of equation there. They don't feel they're being paid adequately enough to train.
One of the ways that I think the BOA and your graduate medical education system is ahead of ours is this full recognition that the trainers need to be trained. Hmm. So I'm very excited at the BOA Congress on Friday. I believe there's a session on training the trainer. So I really look forward to that as part of your upcoming BOA Congress.
Yes, I think that's been a real star in our syllabus or in our work. And that was led a long time ago by Lisa Hadfield-Law, who was an inspirational educationalist. And as a nurse, and she sort of knew a lot of us early on in our careers as she was starting her educationalist career. And she sort of brought us all, not kicking and screaming, but it brought us all into the educational fold. And it's been very impressive.
And again, I think that's an important lesson, that we aren't all experts in everything. And having a PhD consultant or a master's consultant or an educational consultant that helps teach us how to teach and helps us learn how to assess as trainers is a really important leadership lesson to lean on other people's expertise.
And Lisa will be retiring from that role, and I think it's going to be a very exciting challenge for us to find. This time round, it could well be someone within the orthopedic fraternity who is very keen to take education a step further, or it might be better to have someone outside our world. We'll see who applies. It's going to be exciting.
Well, thank you, Deb, for joining me today for this conversation. I think that your leadership journey and your experience in the BOA has really helped broaden the mindset of our AOA members. I think that this has allowed us to have a greater appreciation of the diversity of orthopedic surgery across the world and also the similarities of problems with the care of the musculoskeletal health across the world. So it has been my privilege to spend this time with you discussing these important issues.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Thank you, Deb. I've enjoyed it.